This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on remote with Evie Shockley. Now, she calls herself a woman with an eye on a Black feminist horizon. But I think she's brought that horizon very close to us. Evie, welcome. Give us a poem.
Thank you, Grace. It's wonderful to be here. I think I'll open with the second poem in my new collection, which is about the cover art, or was inspired by the cover art, a sculpture by Allison Saar called Bluebird. The poem is called Perched. I am Black, comely, a girl on the cusp of desire. My dangling toes take the rest of my body refuses. Spine upright, my pose proposes anticipation. I poise in copper-colored tension, intent on manifesting my soul in the discouraging world. Under the rough eyes of others, I stiffen. If I must be hard, it will be as a tree, alive with change. Inside me, a love of beauty rises like sap, sprouts from my scalp, and stretches forth. I send forth my song, an aria blue and feathered, and grow towards it, choirs bare, but soon to bud. I am Black and becoming.
I am Black and becoming, and here it is.
That beautiful bluebird.
And I don't know if that can get on YouTube here. Can you see it, Evie?
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay. So those who cannot see it, will you describe it to us?
So the sculpture, like several of Allison's works, is a kind of a life-size or larger-than-life image of a young girl sitting really sort of taut and upright in a red chair. And she has growing from her head, basically, a tree branch, which is, you know, part of the wood that Allison sculpted the girl from. And it just grows from her head like a long
braid.
Yeah. And at the end of it, there's the little bluebird.
So significant, so symbolic, that braid that becomes a branch with a bird who's about to fly. How much did you have to do with the book design?
I had, thankfully, a lot to do with how picking the art and the graphics and sort of arranging it. Wesleyan's a wonderful press for really understanding how much the visual design matters to books generally and to me in particular. So I'm really grateful to have been able to help really shape that image.
Here's Evie Shockley, and she is the Zora Neale Hurston Distinguished Professor of English at Rutgers University. And we're going to hear another poem.
I think I will read a poem that that is about another young woman, slightly different mood, right? This was a poem about Breonna Taylor, who lived in Kentucky, one of the many people who lost her life to a police killing. I think the only thing I need to say about this poem is that I came to discover while writing it that the Furies, the Greek mythological creatures who were sent to pursue wrongdoers, they each had individual names and individual missions. And so you're going to hear the name of one of them at the end of the poem. Breonna Taylor's Final Rest, or The Furies Are Still Activists. Maybe it's your worst nightmare, a thundering knock on the door, or no knock, just the lightning crack of wood giving way against its nature. Maybe you've never dreamed of such force being used against you, in your home, in your bed. You are cocooned, your heartbeat slow, The darkness is part of what makes you feel safe. The rest is cotton and flesh, your lovers, and the peace you've earned tracking folks' emergencies back and forth all damn day. You remove your uniform, expect to sleep well. Instead, baby, it's your worst nightmare. The thundering knock of your heart beating slower. Darkness is part of what makes us so furious. The fact that the same bloody forces that blew your life to shreds are still free to deliver their next bouquet of violence. Brianna, rest assured, Tisiphone will help us hunt your justice down.
Wow, Evie Shockley. We all remember when those police burst into that door without knocking and murdered. You know,
yes.
Is there any, well, let me put it this way. Every poem honors a person in history, or every poem is inspired by a person in history. Would you say that? I mean, almost every poem on every page. What does this book honor? What did you honor?
That's a really astute observation, Grace. I tend to gather people into my poems, people whose lives I admire, people whose art I admire. This book, in a way, I think rather than maybe honoring as a collection specific people, I think of it as holding up the possibility of gathering together. This title is Suddenly We.
Mm.
And while I don't think that we's collectives form suddenly, in fact, it's a little bit tongue in cheek in that way. I am really interested in this book in the things that make it possible for us to see ourselves as belonging to one another, as in solidarity with one another. And I'm also interested in the obstacles to those.
Clearly. Mm-hmm. And turning them to works of art. Brianna Taylor in the newspaper is a flat, three-dimensional creature. In your poem, she's a living, breathing creature. And Claudia Rankine calls you a master of genealogy. I think that is perfect. Because you are a historian, you are a literary historian and a scholar. And when you put that together with poetry, man, you rock.
You rock.
So let's go on into the content of this book, Suddenly We. And the suddenly is very much like you, because you're very surprising and unexpected. And here you are. Let's hear you. Evie Shockley.
Thank you, Grace. I will actually take up a poem that is by a historical figure who I greatly admire, Ida B. Wells Barnett. Mm. I learned a lot about her life through Paula Giddings, the historian who wrote the wonderful biography, Ida, A Sword Among Lions. This poem comes from some details in the chapters where we learn about Wells at the moment she really takes the first public step towards becoming the activist and sort of revolutionary that we know her as now. It's called No Car for Colored Ladies, or Miss Wells Goes Off on the Rails. Memphis, 1883. She wasn't born a hero, you know. Once she was 20, 4 years an orphan, 18 years free. With a passion for Bronte and a weakness for fashion, she might drop a month of her school teacher's salary on clothing at Minkin's Palatial Emporium to dress as befits a lady. She pays to ride first class that autumn afternoon, knowing she looks the part, full skirt, cinched waist, gloves, crown. Boarding, she peeps the drunken white man smoking up the colored car. And no, she's not buying it. Her place is in the ladies' car. I know she wasn't born a hero, but once Ida B. Wells addresses what befits a lady who pays to ride first class to drift into any which seat she selects, she's becoming one. Outfit be damned, she resists her ouster till her sleeve's torn and the conductor's bleeding. She'll pull these threads until the whole threadbare lie of lynching unravels.
Evie Shockley has won the Hurston Wright Legacy Award. She was a finalist for the Pulitzer. She's had the Poetry Society of America's Shelley Memorial Award, the Lannan Literary Award, the Holmes National Poetry Award, the Stephen Henderson Award for Poetry. Well, just bring them on. You know, as Howard Nemiroff said, bring them on. Uh-huh. And why not? You know, we've heard narrative poems from you, but I have to mention the experimentation in this book. What do you hope to achieve by breaking poetry up on the page so that your aesthetic is so dramatic? What are you saying to us?
You know, one of the things I think I'm hoping to achieve with some of the experimentation in this book is a kind of visual play that is in conversation with the visual artists that I am writing about and after in the collection. In addition to Allison Saar, who I've mentioned and who has the cover art of the book, there are poems about art by Willie Cole, by Alma Thomas, by, you know, Carrie Mae Weems and Cy Twombly. Number of different folks show up. And I love visual art, and I love the aspects of poetry that on the page are visual. And so that's a part of what's going on.
Why can't we have an art show by you? Where you take these all of, from your books, which everyone shows this, and just lift those out and put them in a gallery. It would be like ekphrastic. And what I think you're doing, and you don't know this yet, but I think you are breaking down linear thought, which has become dogma, and breaking history up to make new ground, breaking it up to make new history. And that's what I think your unconscious psyche is really doing.
I love to hear that. I think that's absolutely right.
I do too. Yeah. I know it is, because everything you do is just so bold and so new. And so you just break things up to make new energy. You're just a breakup girl. Let us have another poem by Evie Shockley. We love her so much.
Thank you, Grace. I guess since I was mentioning visual artists, I'll read the whole series. I have a series in this book called The Beauty's Third Dimension that is in conversation with a series of prints by the artist Willie Cole. They're life-size prints that were made by flattening ironing boards to the point where they could be run through a printing press. There's so much more I could say about those images, some of which I was fortunate to be able to reproduce in the book, but I'll just read the first poem from that series. He named his beauties after women in his grandmother's generation who were domestics, and the ironing boards being turned into a kind of an art form is his way of tributing them. My poems take the names of his individual prints. So this one is called Lulabelle. I'm not the first to feel that tingling in my fingers, that pull to read the braille of your body, but I may be the first to ask permission. Merely to eyeball your brocade is to begin weaving a tale, a tapestry of travels and chains, joints and partings. You are stitched with the trajectories of insects, busy, purposeful, multiplicitous. Ink-kissed, you cast quite an impression. I swallow and desire tastes of blueberries. I walk away empty-handed, but but heady, carrying an eyeful of your texture of caress.
Yes, those ironing boards, really, I looked at them and looked at them and thought, only a true genius would do this. I know. How much trust do you have in your reader? How much faith do you, how do you know we're going to follow your meteoric mind? But you do. You do believe we will. What's gotten into you?
I have learned that the readers of poetry are the best readers on the planet. They're the most generous and the most willing to walk with you into unknown territory. And I think that's one of the things that we love about poetry is mystery. And, you know, we've been told that we are supposed to have negative capability and sort of be willing to sit with what we don't understand until maybe some glimmer starts to unfold for us. And so
sit with what we sit until, say that again.
We sit with what we don't understand until
what we don't understand.
Something
that's
begins
a perfect way of describing the art, isn't it? Yes,
it is.
The stillness of it until it becomes alive. That is so good. You say there's no poem unless we can find the courage to speak, and there's no poem unless we can find the courage to hear. Say something about that.
I mean, poetry is one of the spaces where we can confront the hardest truths and the most difficult problems. But if we aren't able to be honest and as writers and open as listeners, poetry can't do its work.
Do your work. Let's hear another, Evie Shockley.
This is a poem. I have a few poems in this collection that mark the fact that the book was at least partly in process, let's just say, during the lockdown and the worst part of the pandemic. And this one is one of the poems that talks about that and does so with a slightly more humorous approach. It's called The Lost Track of Time. Now that I'm on this track, I can't find my way back to the main drag. In the middle of 2020, I carelessly drifted off into a street, not quite a cul-de-sac, but still sacked or socked in, a cloud having swung so low, I got stuck. The flow of traffic, distinguishable Thursdays, next weeks, Augusts, and aughts, carrying on getting carried away without me. Just off screen. Obscene that I seem to have delegated dailiness so long that my mind's convinced it's no longer essential. With last year misty, my brain has relegated the whole of pre-pandemic life to a fog. Is that exhaust fumes? Will I need eye surgery to see my way clear back to that spring in Paris? That year in the Berkshires, that North Carolina decade, cataracts over cacolac. The question is, who was I when we last hugged so close our bones met? Where are the coffee spoons of yesteryear? I've measured out my life in package deliveries and what's in bloom. The time is now 13 boxes past peonies. If you can locate my whenabouts on a calendar, come get me. I don't know where I'm going, but I need a ride.
I liked in your notes when you say, I'm no T.S. Eliot. And I thought, thank God. But you do know every poem that was ever written. I also have to tell people that you have written many books. I actually taught The New Black, and it opened people's eyes New Time. And then Semi-Automatic, I think, was before that. And now suddenly we and that you were a finalist for the LA Times Book Award. Which book was that?
That was Semi-Automatic also.
So you have gotten quite a few trophies. Does it help? Does it make you want to go on? Does it make you know that what you're doing is worth doing? I mean, people joke about awards, but they matter.
You know, it's true that if you think of those as the only thing that matters, you're not going to be able to sustain a life in poetry. That said, I do find it really affirming to have my peers or admired mentors and people whose work I just love say that my work is speaking to them.
And they are the judges. Yes, that is, that's really all it is. Of course, it's in the middle of the night, a trophy doesn't keep you warm, but that is the idea of that group of people sitting around a table and saying, you know, she speaks to me. That's a very precious way to live, I think.
It is.
And how do you think you make energy in a poem?
You put the language up against the wall and squeeze.
I will remember that. Stop right there. Boy, you have said it all. That is right. You do, don't you?
But if
people don't do that, what happens to language?
Oh, I mean, it's so easy to just use language in the same way we do day in and day out, which is both full of dead metaphors. We say the same things, hoping that people know what we mean. And language can be really limp in that case. What poets have to do is create the combinations of words that really rejuvenate our experience of language. So we can be, I guess, startled into thinking about what we're actually saying.
Evie Shockley rinses off language. And so she's going to go on with another poem from Suddenly We.
Yes. So this poem was part of a portfolio of poems that I created from a commission by the University of Arizona Poetry Center, their Art for Justice grant, which asked me to focus some energy on writing poems about the prison industrial complex and mass incarceration. This poem is called Virtually Free. He can do the running man, but no running. Any dance that shows she knows her place. Coffle shuffle merengue or nay nay. No iron cuffs to chafe the ankle. Just jewelry that makes a statement, sends a signal. You're at the end of a rope. Oh, rope, your rope. See Marissa stop. Stop, Marissa, stop. Marissa stops and shops for food at the corner store. Real groceries are outside her perimeter, outside her radius, I'm sorry. She's got to work within convenience, a perimeter she's made aware of by what she's awarin'. Her reality isn't apparent to the unaided eye. Nothing to see here, folks, but surveillance cameras are in place in this place, just in case. Catch Jamal, tech junkie, hardwired to his device, tethered by a 2-hour battery life to the wall of his history class. Jamal got to have that juice. The boy needs an outlet. AJ's shackled to a monthly fee for the privilege of parole. Their freedom isn't free. These are the people in our neighborhood, on lockdown, on the block. It's a negated community. Confines virtually invisible, but for the faint red lines.
A negated community. One goes from margin to margin. Would you call it a prose poem?
I would, indeed.
Okay. And people need to know that means something. It means that it's still lyrical, that you still repeat sounds inside of the line, that you have a sprung line, that, I mean, just because we look at it as a paragraph, it has to have a lot going on, right?
Everything except line breaks. That's the only thing a prose poem doesn't do that other poems do.
Finally, I have a definition for it, because people always say, what is a prose poem? And I say, I don't know, started by Valerie. That's all I know, but it's got everything but line breaks. Now I know the answer to that. And what made you do it in a prose-like way instead of vertical?
I think that something about the subject suggested, I mean, it's about the use of electronic sort of It's about the ways that you can use technology to allow people to not be in jail, but to be under house arrest.
Yes.
They can only go within a certain radius before the alarm is set off. And so thinking about a poem that's about confinement like that, I thought that having the prose, which is sort of left and right justified, would give the poem a feeling of confinement, that, you know, the white space that often we think of as an opening at the ends of lines wouldn't be there in this case.
Clearly, the form and the content match here, so that you wanted to have compression, as you say, and limits. And
yes.
You didn't want, and always your aesthetics on the page are part of your thinking. And so do you paint additionally and draw and do other art?
I wish. I mean, I have a secret desire to be a visual artist, but no talent in that arena. So the poetry page is the only place I seem to be able to.
Don't say that, because there's always tomorrow.
Well,
with you, there's always tomorrow if you'll just take a day off. But let us go on. Here's Evie Shockley with another poem.
So this one is also part of the Arts for Justice grant that I did. So thinking again about the criminal justice system, justice being in quotation marks. And I guess there's also a connection back to T.S. Eliot, whose lines seem to just haunt my brain, for better or for worse. This is called Jury Duty. And there are two epigraphs. The first says, almost no one ever goes to trial. Nearly all criminal cases, 97%, are resolved through plea bargaining. And that's from Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. The second epigraph, let us go and make our visit, T.S. Eliot. Jury Duty. No one wants to be there. Many of us glitter like the sea in sunshine, shedding sweat or tears at the mere thought of a criminal court. Such proximity to police, to cuffs and charges, to be trapped playing a role in some tragedy, condemner uncomfortably close to the condemned. Many others think instantly of opportunity costs. Time is money. Who can afford to spend 3 to 5 days worth listening to the lawyers coming and going through the oceans of files, talking of boys who were no angels? No. To serve is a right and our duty, each to each. But the potential juror peers into the courtroom as if it were quarantined for the plague. Once, years ago, my father served. That evening fell stormy. The darkness intensified by winds that made our metal screen door buzz like a warped harmonica. As we waited dinner for him, the power failed. My sister and I, young and younger, shrieked until our mom lit the fat candle in its plastic container painted to look like stained glass. As we sat distracted by flickering scenes of Jesus's miracles, the phone rang. Our father's one call to tell our mother that the jury would be sequestered overnight. In courthouse cells, we misbelieved. Daddy's in jail, we girls wailed. Our lives had been a steady caravan of cautions and counsels, inevitably ending in stay out of prison. We hardly dared imagine that anyone, once caught behind bars, emerged again. The next day brought morning sun and father in the afternoon. We greeted him as if he'd come from the dead. Would it be a hardship to serve 3 weeks? Dutiful jurors in my state are asked. The line to plead excuses runs long. Meanwhile, money, or lack thereof, is time for all the men and women awaiting trial in cells they can't bail themselves out of. They hear the prosecutors spooning out their lives, inviting the accused, "Sing to me." They sing, a loud chorus of bodies, white and brown and black, flooding prisons in waves, while we malinger on the beach in our own sequestered chambers. Their human voices wake us, or we drown.
The legislatures of the world, you poets. Mm. You certainly are the legislatures of the world. And
we poets.
What are we going to do but speak loudly, and somebody will hear, someone will hear. And this book has so much in it. Each of your books is very different in a way, although the intention is the same. I think The New Black was revolutionary for my students anyway. And have we gotten any feedback from this book yet?
I've just gotten a lot of really affirming, calls and emails from readers. People I don't know have surprised me with messages. I'm really encouraged by
it. It's new, too. It hasn't been, it's just out, really. And you say your mother is your chief champion?
She is always a supporter. Constant. Yep.
Yeah, I liked reading all of your accolades, and your notes are really as good as the poems, I think. People should not stop at the end of the poems. And let's have another. Evie Shockley is our guest. She is from Rutgers, and she's going to be all over California soon.
This poem is the second to last poem in the book, and it's also about an artwork by Allison Saar, but this time a big public installation of hers. A much larger than life size sculpture of Harriet Tubman. It's based in Harlem, and the poem's title comes out of the small controversy, you might say, that happened when the sculpture was unveiled. People noted that Tubman was facing south, and Allison responded to this suggestion that she should be facing north by noting that Tubman went back several times. So the direction was not unintentional. This poem is called Facing South, after Allison Saar. And there are two epigraphs. The first, as long as you are south of the Canadian border, you are south. That's Malcolm X. Now, even the North Pole is south. That's me. Facing south. Swing low, sweet charioteer. It's the wretched of the earth you're coming for, who will be found in the overlooked places, still bent to the soil and poisoned with it, still chained to each other's stink and sharing laughter like a virus, still working through illness and keeling over on the job, still going hungry to feed the owner's retirement, still smoothing the sheets the master poet sleeps on, still torn away from mother, brother, daughter, lover, earning maybe enough to keep them clothed, but not enough to keep them close. Oh, Harriet Chariot, swing lower than Maryland, swing wider, swing by the maquiladoras, swing by the detention centers, swing by the orange groves, swing by the slaughterhouses, swing by the bistros after lunch, the tables heavy on dishes and light on tips. Swing by Angola's cotton fields and Compton's streets. Swing by the taqueria and the storefront church. Swing by Danville, by Oaxaca, by Manila. Swing by Flint. Swing by chain retailers' break rooms, fast food restaurants, kitchens, and every place with public in its name. We see you in Harlem with a dress full of roots and kin, a look of granite on your face, one hand open and the other a fist. You're mid-stride and headed our way. We're coming from deeper, broader, and further south, at times like you on foot, trudging towards a north that's receding like a glacier. From east and west, we're pushing towards you, seek citizenship in your determination. Whichever way we're headed, we're facing the facts. There's no turning back now.
That is the voice of Evie Shockley. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family, by Natalie Canivore and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.